Hello to all the Natural Perfume Academy podcast listeners from Galway in Ireland. Today, I am very, very happy to say that we are back and that our first guest in this revival journey is Solomon Murrow. Solomon lives in Mexico City and is the founder of Parfolab, which is a certified educational perfumery school, and it is accredited by the Natural Perfume Academy. He is a perfumer and a tea and wine sommelier, and he also has a strong background in chemistry. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here, Solomon.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Lovely, lovely. I also wanted to say that this episode will be aired on the 6th of October, and that is the first Monday of October, and it's going to coincide with our Mexico Monday feature, which will run on the first Monday of every month. I'm just letting our listener know to watch out for that. So it will be, sometimes we might have a feature on YouTube, sometimes on Substack and on our website as well on NPA Press. So keep an eye out for that as well. And this podcast itself will take all kinds of twists and turns, but we're starting with Mexico. Before we say any more, I'm going to launch into the first question. And I wanted to come up with something to get the juices flowing right away. Don't worry, Solomon, it's not a curveball I'm going to throw you. But I'm conscious of people say how everybody's attention span these days was very short. But I do believe that if the material is strong, people do have the attention span to actually listen. So hopefully that's what I want for this podcast, and want to develop it into something for the listener first and foremost. And of course, it's about you and it's about the guest, but I do believe that the guest is here for the listener, and the topics that we bring up, I want them to have value and hopefully a bit of entertainment as well. You know, so Solomon, I'm going to just get on to the first juicy question, and we'll have lots of other topics to explore. I'll just dive in. This is a fun one. If I hand you a cup of tea, a glass of wine, or a strip of perfume, are you speaking three different languages, or is it all one shared vocabulary for you?
What a great question. So this is a complicated question because on the one hand, you are able to appreciate perfume, tea, and wine thanks to the same sense, which is a sense of smell. So ideally and in theory, we should be able to use a broad vocabulary to talk about anything smell-wise. This being said, I do feel like every industry has its own particular terminology to describe things. So in my honest opinion, the most pure and accurate way or discipline to describe the smell of things comes from perfumery, because we do get to evaluate the raw aromatics in their purest form. And what I believe happens a lot in the world of wine and tea is that they have developed their very own language to describe what you have in front of you, which is not entirely based on the real stuff. So for instance, in the world of wine, I always argue about three particular notes that are super common in the wine world. So one of those is musk. So in the world of winemaking, something that smells musky is like a super dirty, pungent animalic, which we know in the world of perfumery that there are animalics that are way more pungent, and musky is usually used to describe a skin scent or something that is much cleaner. Another example would be violet. So in the world of winemaking, when they describe violet in a wine, they are maybe unknowingly describing the synthetic violet, not really the natural violet, which we know is super green. Another one is blackcurrant. So if you do get to smell a blackcurrant absolute, you always get this really funky,
yeah, that's
catchy
right. I know it. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And in the world of wine, they sometimes lack this distinctive or characteristic pea aroma. So for me, what it comes down to is it's not a sense of superiority of or of me being right just because I've had the opportunity to smell the real stuff. It's just sort of adapting the vocabulary and realizing what they are trying to say. So we have definitely all of these worlds have their very, very own vocabulary. But in the end, if you are willing to just not fall into like all the technicalities of the words that are being used, and you are open to just go through this mental process of, okay, so in the world of wine, they said A, but in the world of perfumery, this would really mean B. So instead of debating about who has the correct vocabulary, I think it's just a way better strategy to go through this mental process and interpret what they are trying to say and what you're trying to express.
Wow. I love that. Yeah. It's given me a lot of food for thought. When you look at YouTube, you can find a lot of information about tea tasters and wine tasters and the kind of the strategy that they use to do it. Like, I mean, you're familiar with that, and I wasn't familiar at all. And, kind of breaking things into types first so that you can kind of get your brain around the vocabulary and the categorizations and all of that kind of thing and the characterizations. But even though I understand myself the strategy for evaluating in perfumery, there isn't a lot out there, is there, in terms of like just on YouTube or, for the actual technique of like how to smell. I know that's what we teach. But I think it's something that I just found that interesting, the way that it was kind of really freely available out there, how to taste tea, how to smell taste wine, but how to smell perfume didn't seem to be. There were lots of people smelling perfume, but nobody actually showing the technique there. So I just thought that was quite interesting.
I do believe that also comes down to the fact that both the world of tea and the world of wine particularly are they're way more structured. Like you do actually get a wheel of aromas for both of these beverages, which literally tell you which kinds of things you should be describing or which words you should be using. And I think that does not happen for perfume. The world of perfumery is way broader. Like it is good in the world of perfume to use as many words as you want and to express what you're smelling with as much detail, emotion as possible. Whereas in the world of tea and wine, there are like some solid basis of what you are meant to find and what is the adequate and inadequate way of smelling and evaluating the beverage. And I also do think that this is because both the world of wine and the world of tea, even though definitely it is definitely the sense of smell which gives these beverages their distinct personalities, and which is usually recognized as the most important characteristic of a wine or of a tea. The tasting of wine and tea has to use other senses as well. So you use your taste, you use your vision, and these are all part of like the protocol of tasting. So it's usually what is said in the world of specialty beverages is you evaluate in the order of your face. So first come your eyes, then your nose, and then your mouth. And that is like something that is a common way of evaluating things across the world of many specialty beverages. Whereas in the world of perfume, you really just 100% focus on the sense of smell. And you're not gonna let me lie, you can spend as much time as you want with a single sense trip, and I'll smell it with all these different techniques and come back and let it evolve into something different and come back to it again. And it's in a way less structured, but more freeing to evaluate the world of perfumery.
Yeah, that's right, actually. One thing that I noticed was with wine, I'm not a big wine drinker myself. I'm a little bit more now than I was when I was younger, but I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference between a good wine or not. Or so I thought, probably until I actually tasted a wine that I liked. And then I suddenly was like all interested because I think Ireland, we're not really big wine drinkers. We're big maybe whiskey drinkers, beer drinkers, but what I noticed was that they were talking about like how long it stays on the palate or the taste. And then I thought, oh, the correlation there between perfumery. or with perfumery, where you would have that would be a really big thing, wouldn't it? Like the whole time on the strip and where you kind of leave it and then you write the time down. There's a lot of that, isn't there? Recording. And I just find it hard. Like, I mean, you might have any tips there just for finding the words. It's like having the confidence to say there's no right or wrong answer. I think that's one of the things with me is there a right answer? Is there a wrong answer? What if I say that it smells like something that it doesn't smell like? And I did see something a few years ago where there were four different professional perfumers from different parts of the world, all smelling the same material and coming up with completely different characters for this particular material. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. They're all describing these different things, but they're smelling the same thing. Did you learn any kind of, or do you have any tips there with when it comes to like finding the right words or having the confidence?
I would definitely say stay true to yourself. I believe that every mind is a world of its own. And the vocabulary that you might use to describe a smell is definitely shaped not only by your personal experiences, but also by the culture and the environment where you grew up in. So that is definitely something that happens as well in Mexico, like particularly in the world of wine. We usually find a lot of fruits and flowers that are native to Mexico, which are not part of like the internationally recognized protocol of wine tasting. So I personally have always believed that it's way more valuable to being free to express what you are smelling rather than sticking to a script. So I think it definitely comes down to confidence, to trusting your senses. And at the end of the day, absolutely no one can tell you or can tell anyone what they are smelling and what they are not.
Exactly. That's it, isn't it? Like I, with my kids here, I'll sometimes let them smell something and they'll really surprise me. They'll say it smells like this. And it's something that it wouldn't have occurred to me. And so it again, yeah, it's like trusting yourself and just having that confidence. And also like that as well, it is kind of practice, isn't it?
As with absolutely anything. And it is, I think it is always a great idea to listen to how other people describe that same thing, simply because you can definitely take some ideas or maybe try looking for something specific that you had not found before. And at the end of the day, it just makes it a more complete experience.
Yeah. That brings me now to something that you know a lot about, and I feel like that our listeners would be really interested in, and that is custom perfumery. In a way, custom perfumery was what sort of brought me into the whole world of natural perfumery, because I wanted to have a custom perfume made for my skincare brand. And that just brought me down a huge journey that I'm still on. But I do think that it's one of the, there's a lot of regulations and it's very hard to get your products onto the actual shelves and shops, and there's a lot of competition out there. So I think it's one of the areas that I think a lot of perfumers could kind of see themselves in, is creating custom perfumes for people, and especially people that kind of have everything or that they're willing to kind of invest in it for maybe a special occasion or something like that. But again, just going back to that kind of skill that you have, like with your clients, then you like say, with perfume, like with wine, if you were given someone, like I have a bar down the road there and they specialize in craft beers. And so sometimes you'll go in and they might have a new craft beer and they'll give you a little taste and you can say if you like it or not, but they're just giving you the taste of the beer. Whereas with perfumery, it's not as simple as that, is it? When you're doing custom perfumery, because, you know, you're not going to just let somebody smell Africa stone tincture just straight out of the bottle. They'll just be like, oh, what is that? Don't put that in anything that I want that you're making for me. But like, if you then diluted it down to its kind of, so you can not even smell it anymore, and then you let them smell, say, Africa stone tincture, sort of layered under sort of maybe rose, and then compare it with just rose without Africa stone tincture, that they're not actually smelling the Africa stone tincture, they're smelling what it does to the rose.
I believe that when you are in the world of custom-made perfumery, you have to make some compromises, first and foremost. So I think a lot of people do not realize how hard it actually is to create a perfume. And in my experience, a lot of people usually think it's going to be a way simpler, a way easier, a way cheaper process than it actually is. So I
Oh
think that
yeah,
is
I
a,
was one of those.
definitely. So I think that is like a super important disclaimer, which is if you really want an amazing custom-made perfume, you have to be willing to spend time, money, and effort. And if you do not want to spend all this time, money, and effort, then you can definitely make some compromises. And one of these compromises, I think, falls precisely in what you were just describing with the Avric stone and the rose. So it also comes down to how much would you want, or are you willing to involve your customer in the creative process? Like at which point are you the perfumer, which is leading the experience, and who is the expert in making the right choices and combining the correct aromatics? And at which point is this a perfume for the customer who should be fully involved in the whole creative process? So it is, I believe that you can take several different postures, none of which are necessarily the right one or better than the other. So you can either have a business model of custom-made perfumery, which is 100% custom-made with what that implies, which is a lot of time, a lot of effort, and maybe a lot of money involved, just due to how much work is put into that and how many raw materials are being used to get to that final product. Or you can go to the other end of the spectrum, which is something I personally like to call semi-custom made, which is where you already have some things that might be remixed or pre-formulated, and you're just essentially giving your customer a few options to choose without involving your customer from moment zero. So there are several ways to do it, and I do believe that custom-made perfumery is a viable business model, as long as you understand who your customer is, how much time, money, and effort they're willing to put into creating this perfume, and figuring out the best way to do it according to your very own context.
Well, that's very good, actually. I never even thought of that as an idea to sort of it became, I don't know if it's a new thing now exactly anymore, but it was something my daughter had this idea. She had seen others doing it. So it's like, let's say for hair. So you have a certain type of hair and you want to order, there's a website where you can kind of build your own sort of shampoo based on what they have available. Like they're not making anything from scratch. You're just kind of choosing from a group, you're choosing, say, okay, I have dry hair or whatever, and so I want this particular type of conditioner that does this, this, and this. So I know what you're saying. It would narrow it down, but it also would allow them to feel like that they're actually creating something, without it being, because yeah, it's like if somebody says, you know, paint me a picture, or you know, create me a logo. You know, it all depends on how much they're willing to spend, how much time they have, or when they want it, and of course, as well, the quality of the materials. If you go into a Michelin star restaurant where you know all of the vegetables and everything that's in there, they're just, you know, locally purchased. They've all organic, or they're just top quality. You're not going to make anything in that restaurant from sort of low quality stuff, is it? So like you say, that's a huge thing. I mean, it's known, like you say, it's known who your market is.
In my experience with launching this business model in Mexico, that is something that made me realize just how far behind the perfumery culture in Mexico essentially is. So our first attempt at custom-made perfumery in Mexico came from this idea of formulating from scratch, of only using locally sourced natural raw materials, and of having these really personal sessions with our customers. or we would guide them step by step, and we would sometimes even take hours in creating each of these formulas. And at the end of the day, we quickly realized that the average consumer was not seeing the value of, number one, the kind of aromatics we were using. Number two, they felt like taking that many hours in creating our perfume was a burden rather than a plus towards their custom-made experience. And we simply realized that it was, at least for the context of the Mexican market at that time, it was simply too much. It was too custom-made, even to the point that people weren't willing to spend time, money, and effort into that perfume. And at the end of the day, when you are in the world of custom-made perfumery, you also get some requests that are sometimes not necessarily ethical. So, for instance, in our case, and that is sadly a reality in Mexico, but one of the things that are sold the most in the context of perfumery in Mexico are dupes. So a lot of people would realize we had a custom-made lab where you could create your very own perfume, and instead of seeing the value of, oh, I can create an original perfume from scratch, they would see it as a way to create a dupe or something similar to a perfume that was out there, which they could no longer find or which they didn't want to pay for. No, and of course, we always said no to these kind of requests. But it is important to know and to be somewhat realistic about how not everyone that walks through the door is going to have that same vision or enthusiasm for spending a whole bunch of time, money, and effort on creating a perfume. And some people might just see this as a perfume lab where you can create whatever you want, and you're not really willing to really dive deep into the whole world of perfumery.
Yeah, which is not what you're about at all. It's kind of the opposite of what you're about, rather than trying to replicate something that's already out there. And it's funny how they do that. They just, oh, will you create this for me? Like you say, it's already either out there, they can't get it anymore, or they're not willing to pay for it, and they think that's, whereas it's totally not that at all. And how about, like, have you any interesting stories from that whole aspect of things, from custom perfumery, that would, I think people love listening to not necessarily mistakes, but areas where you learned something.
So there were definitely a lot of mistakes that, looking back into the past, there are a lot of things that I would have done differently. So number one is there is another project in Mexico that focuses on custom-made perfumery. And their business model is basically they have a set of, I don't know, 10, 15 perfumes, which are already pre-made, prefabricated, formulated. And sort of what you were mentioning with the whole shampoo and conditioner thing, they have this website where you can just select, answer like a 3 or 4 question quiz, and the website will tell you which perfume is for you. And then they will add this really nice detail of adding your name to a label. So my personal and professional opinion is this isn't really custom made because you're just choosing from a pool of pre-existing perfumes. But I do have to recognize that that is an amazing strategy for the context of Mexico, simply because people do get this feeling that they're getting involved in the process and they do get this perfume with their name on the label, which is always exciting, without really needing to spend a lot of time, money, and effort. So I think looking back, I would have definitely, it would have been a good idea to maybe operate this business model from a place where it can just make it way simpler for both me and the consumer, and not as broad and as maybe passionate driven as it was originally created. A huge mistake that we did commit as well was, surprisingly, only sticking to locally sourced aromatics. And why was this a mistake? Because I know that usually sourcing locally always seems like a great idea. But the reality is that the availability of aromatics in Mexico is little to none. especially when compared to the US or to Europe. So at the time, we had unintentionally and with the best of intentions, but we had limited the raw materials that we had available for our customers to smell and to use and to incorporate into their perfumes. And they would often have like these specific requests of aromatics they had heard of or that they knew were in some of the perfumes they already enjoyed. And we simply did not have them in stock because they were not sold in Mexico. So looking back, I should have probably been super open from moment zero to import and get aromatic source from everywhere in the world because unfortunately you cannot get them here in Mexico. So it is for me I definitely realized that while locally sourcing things is always a great idea, if you cannot get something locally, you have to make a choice. Either stick to the what can be locally sourced and hence limit your very own perfumer's organ, or make the compromise of having to import stuff from everywhere in the world where, well, yeah, it's not locally sourced anymore, but at least now I have a way broader perfumer's organ. So that's something that also in retrospect was an important mistake. The same goes for all the perfume bottles. So during COVID, which is when we launched this project at first, glass and crystal was super, super, super scarce in Mexico City, in Mexico was in general. But so some of the suppliers that usually carried, I don't know, 100 different models of perfume bottles would at that time only carry three or four. So even the choosing the packaging at the time was a little bit awkward because it was never from the get-go a packaging we were necessarily proud of or that we were necessarily into. It was more of a this is what is available. And once again, since we only wanted to source locally, we ended up not looking, to be entirely honest, at our very own perfume bottles and packaging with pride and with joy, to the point that we eventually needed to invest again in redesigning and getting completely different bottles and printing completely new boxes for these new bottles. And it was something that I realized I should have not rushed or compromised on something as crucial as packaging when we were not 100% convinced. Because in on the long run, it was just more expensive and more wasteful. So those were the key mistakes that we faced while operating our business the first time. Something really amazing, like a fun little anecdote that we had at the time, is that since this was right after COVID, we did get some customers that wanted to create a perfume, but they were unable to smell a lot of things. And something that was a huge challenge
That's crazy.
was, yes, creating a perfume for someone who is not able to smell maybe 75% of the things you have in front of them, and where you cannot just ask them to blindly trust you that this smells amazing and you should wear it even though you can't even smell it and appreciate it. So
Yeah.
it was a super, super challenging and rewarding experience as well, because if this whole experience did teach me anything, was that as a perfumer, it is always a great idea to have as many aromatics as you can. And it's always amazing, to be honest. But it
Yeah.
is an even better idea to be able to do more with less.
Right. Yeah. It's so funny because it's almost like you're describing a lot of the mistakes, similar mistakes that I did with my business as well, just by limiting myself, ended up when you look into the future, then you go, oh God, why did I do that? And it ends up being the mistakes are quite costly. I suppose it does kind of like if anything is to be learned, I suppose it is like to have a sort of forward thinking, or what they say, hindsight is 20/20 vision, isn't that what they say?
I completely 100% agree. We also, after we decided to shut down the custom made experience, which involved the consumer and so on, we tried launching an online version. And what was weird over there, it was that, so number one, it was a way more successful business model given the context of Mexico, simply because people were able to create their very own perfume online from scratch. So we would include these really specific descriptions of all the aromatics we had. We also imported a whole bunch of aromatics, so we now had a broader catalog, which was definitely a better business model than the physical perfumery with people where people would go to. But at the end of the day, we then got the other complaint, which was, how can I smell online? So how can I create a perfume? I appreciate all of these really accurate descriptions, but how can I smell online? And for us, it was a eye-opening, because at the end of the day, no matter which way you decide to do it, some people will not agree, some people will not want to be involved in the sort of a path or mechanism which you've decided to create or to impart. And you just have to stay true to yourself and know why you are doing what you're doing, know why you're doing the things, or I'm sorry, how you're doing the things and the why behind that. And speaking to the consumer that is your very realistic target, and not pretending that absolutely everyone who wants a custom made perfume in this instance will be on board with the way you are planning on creating it for them.
Yeah, that's a very good insight, actually. You can't keep everybody happy, but also I think it's people getting their heads around certain things as well. Like I remember when the perfume course first started, people would say, "How are you teaching perfume course online? Sure, like how can you do that when it's online?" And then again, going back to COVID, because COVID, the pandemic did change the world. There weren't a lot of online courses. There were, but there weren't a lot. They weren't everywhere. And then what COVID taught people, and also it didn't just teach people, it taught service providers how to give people the tools to be able to teach online. Whereas before, okay, people did have those tools, but they weren't being used mainstream in classrooms and things like that. And so it just became this kind of mainstream thing. And like it did definitely change the course of the Natural Perfume Academy anyway. But yeah, it's interesting just exactly how much, even it's 2025 now, but it's amazing just how much it's actually changed the world. And I do, you did mention something about COVID being that kind of a little bit of a catalyst for you as well to start doing things online, wasn't it?
Definitely. So I actually had to finish my university degree completely online. And what ended up happening is I had a bunch of free time, fortunately. And my family and I, while we were in lockdown, we decided to start doing something useful or valuable with our time. So we started taking a whole bunch of different courses, which eventually became longer and longer and more specific and specialized courses. And that is how I eventually got into both the world of tea. I got certified as a tea sommelier online, and to the world of perfumery. I'm a proud graduate of the Natural Perfume Academy. And if it had not been an option online, I would have maybe never taken this path. And the beauty of online education is that you can reach people wherever they are in the world. And it marked a before and after for my career, for my profession, for what I plan to do with my life. So yes, COVID definitely did change a lot of things for a lot of people.
Yeah, it did. And another thing as well, just I don't know if you agree with this, but I did a course for a Dr. Delish Clare, like a herbalist course. So this is now going back, oh, it must be 10 years ago now. So it'll be just a series of videos. And then I also use Moodle to do it. But what she wanted to do, and at the time I was thinking, okay, that actually is a really good idea. So rather than kind of gatekeeping the knowledge and saying, okay, this knowledge is sort of my knowledge and you have to pay to get it, she made the knowledge freely available. And then, so she would get people interested in her course. And I would say, well, it's there. It's all there on YouTube. You can actually do, all of the information is there. But if you want to join the academy and get a certification and follow through with quizzes and be able to kind of be guided and mentored by Dr. Dealish Clare, that's what you pay for. So I really like that model because the knowledge is there for people. There isn't that sense of gatekeeping, but then there is that sense of kind of a support community, and that when people are looking for that support, that's when they find you. And I think it's a much kind of a, not saying a healthier model, but it's a model that kind of follows a sort of an attitude of abundance rather than scarcity, if you know what I mean.
I completely agree. I am a firm believer that the more knowledge we share, the better the end result for the industry as a whole. I think that anything we learn has to be shared with anyone who is willing to hear. And I also do agree on what you are saying, because at the end of the day, I feel like today we are able to learn whatever we want. There are a whole bunch of resources online, and you can virtually learn absolutely anything you put your mind into. So I think that the real value of having an academy or teaching in an academy comes not really from the information you are giving, because this information might be available online or in several other resources, but precisely this very sense of community, this very sense of being able to talk to a person and having a person express their very own personal experiences, and just like feeling supported and rewarded for how you are progressing in this new thing you were trying to learn.
100%. That's exactly it. One of the things I was thinking as I was kind of putting this together, because I'm hoping that this isn't going to be your only session with us, is where what I was talking about is different perfumers in different parts of the world as a kind of like a scent panel. I'd love to see something like that happening. Do you think you'd be interested in something like that in the future?
That sounds like an amazing initiative. So count me in.
Oh, that's fantastic. What I wanted, one of the things I suppose, like a kind of philosophy, which is never let lack of money stop you doing what you want to do. You do the planning first and then it comes. But if your resources were completely unlimited, like if you just had all the resources at your fingertips, what kind of project, or where would you see your project going?
Oh, what a difficult question.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. I'm sorry.
No, don't worry. It's super interesting. I think I would probably love to do two things. Assuming that money isn't something that could stop me in this hypothetical scenario. So number one would definitely be to make aromatics more available in Mexico. So this means both importing them and maybe giving even free spaces or opportunities for people to actually be able to smell them. Because if people do not get to smell what all of these aromatics smell like, how can we expect them to know to look for them in a perfume or to appreciate them in a perfume? So that would be number one. I would even love to set up like an, it would be amazing to have like this place where sort of like a museum of smell, where people could just go and smell whatever it is they wish to smell, but also make it make all of these available for perfumers to actually be able to purchase and use in their very own projects. So I think that would be number one. And number two, which is something that is super personal to me, is the fact that in Mexico, we are always very proud about all the abundance of plants that are native to Mexico, and of how many of the most popular aromas come from Mexico. So you get vanilla, you get cacao, you get tuberose, you get copal, you get a whole bunch of different plants that come from here, and you're always super proud of that. However, none of these are actually being produced nowadays in Mexico as raw materials for perfumery. So yeah, we do grow cacao, we do grow vanilla, we do grow tuberose, but no one is actually making an absolute or an aromatic of any kind out of these. And if you dig deeper into that, you find out that there are a whole bunch of communities in Mexico which have their very own local super unknown species of flowers or of fruits or of, in general, aromatic plants. And it would be a gift to the world if these could actually be used in perfumery. And it will also be a gift for all of these communities to be able to support them in creating an additional income or additional product from the very own thing that nature gives them. So all this to say that my second idea would definitely be to set up a nationwide project where we would probably work with all of these local communities to ethically and sustainably source all of these exotic aromatics and have them available for perfumers all over the world.
That's the key, isn't it? The sustainably and ethically. But if you're going to do something that hasn't been done before, you've got to do it the right way the first time, don't you? It's hard to get organic perfumery materials, but when you start growing something organically and you're certified organic, you have to follow certain rules. But again, it's a romantic idea, isn't it? Rather than something that you could say is going to be an economically viable idea, if you like.
For it to work on the long run, it definitely has to be economically viable. If no one is, if no one were willing to purchase these exotic Mexican aromatics, there would be no real point from an economic view to keep producing them. So I think that is one of the biggest challenges. In order to make it sustainable, it's not only about environmental impact and social impact, it's also about economic impact. And if the pillar of economy is not there in these sorts of projects, they are usually doomed to collapse eventually. So it whether we like it or not, a project of this of this magnitude definitely would have to be economically viable for it to even make sense to everyone involved.
That's it. It's a fairly close knit kind of, like, in other words, like where vanilla comes from, it's where suppliers are used to getting it. And I mean, that's the other thing about perfumers as well. They're not just going to buy a small amount of something that they're never going to be able to get again, especially if they're developing a professional perfume line. They need to be fairly sure that they're going to be able to get that material again in the future and that it's fairly consistent and all of those kind of things as well. So what I was going to ask you then is, like, in terms of sort of courses coming up, and just for our listener, or if there's any, you want to point anybody in any direction.
Of course. So right now we are 100% focused on our diploma course in perfumery, which is a 1 year long diploma course that aims to teach all the different pillars and disciplines needed to develop a perfumery business or a career in perfumery. So our perspective is to not only teach the technical or really artistic aspects of perfumery, but also, of course, talking about the legality of things, of sustainability, of ethics, of marketing, packaging design, PR, history, culture, all of these other things that are 100% involved and are 100% useful for someone who's about to begin their journey in the world of perfumery. So that is our main focus right now. The truth is, this is the very first course of its kind in Mexico, and I would even dare say in Latin America. So, or at least in Hispanic America. So anyway, it is, I feel like this is like step one towards offering even more specialized or even more specific courses in the near future. So there are definitely a lot of internal discussions about maybe number one, either expanding our diploma course to the rest of Latin America, or at least Hispanic America. Number two, to maybe launching some specialized courses in either advanced perfumery or distillation or production of raw materials in the near future for our students that have already graduated from our main course. So there are definitely a lot of interesting plans in the future, but we do have to be really mindful about the fact that less than 2 years ago, there was absolutely nowhere where you could study anything of this kind in Mexico. So we do want to evolve our educational offer alongside the Mexican population in general. So as our students evolve and as the standard of perfumery in Mexico evolves, we are definitely looking into evolving as a school as well. But right now, we are definitely still highly focused on this first and most important crucial step, which is a basic education in perfumery in general.
That is fantastic. It's just in its infancy, so.
Yes, definitely. It is definitely in its infancy.
And another thing I actually noticed a lot more, I think this year really, is that, when I first started, I was kind of thinking natural perfumers are just for people who are interested in just naturals. But actually, working with only naturals can be quite a challenge for even experienced perfumers who are at it for years. When they decide to say, okay, I want to have a look at this, it's almost like working in that different medium of, let's say, I've been painting fine art for years and years and years using acrylics and using oil, and I go to the shop and I buy lots of the pigments and different things like that. And then one day I decide, look, I'm going to actually start making my own pigments from oak gall ink, and I'm going to use turmeric, I'm going to use this or that, and I start making all my own kind of colors. The whole to create a composition, it's just going to be so different, isn't it? And I think that even the best perfumer in the world who's maybe used to working with synthetics, and not just synthetics, obviously, because mainstream perfumery, that's another kind of myth, is mainstream perfumery has lots of natural components in it, but it's to have that broader palette that kind of makes it not necessarily easier, but it's definitely more challenging when you've got this kind of like narrower palette where you have this challenge of that you're not necessarily able to suddenly produce this kind of like raspberry or peach note that somebody that you might want in a composition. You've got to kind of do something different.
I 100% agree. And to add on to what you were mentioning, I would also like to say that it also comes down to numbers at the end of the day. Because even if, for instance, I am in love with natural aromatics and I've had the opportunity to smell both synthetics and naturals, and that is precisely why I am able to blindly say that naturals are definitely the what smell more amazing to me. Like, for me, that is not a question at all. But at the end of the day, it definitely does come down to numbers. So whether we like it or not, the industry is dominated by these really synthetic rich compositions, which are super cheap. So even in the minds of the consumers, they believe that certain aromatic profiles or certain types of perfumes are meant to be within a certain price range. And when you try to do something that is 100% natural, you also face the challenge of not being competitive price-wise. And definitely, you could definitely start talking to a different audience or a different target, which will appreciate the fact that it is 100% natural. But I've personally toned it down, and what we movie tell the aspiring perfumers here in Mexico is, okay, you do not necessarily have to do perfumes that are 100% natural. What you should be doing is, number one, be completely sure of what you're putting into your perfume and why are you putting that into that perfume, be it a natural or a synthetic. And of course, number two, as long as you try to include at least a natural aromatic into your composition, for the context of Mexico, I call that a win. Even if it's not a 100% natural composition, it is. I believe that we often think that the transition from synthetics to naturals has to be an abrupt one or something that happens overnight, where I think it's way more realistic to realize that, okay, if a perfumer was going to do something that was 100% synthetic, and thanks to all this information we've provided, and thanks to the opportunity of this perfumer being able to source and smell a natural ingredient, this perfumer swapped at least one of his if, of the ingredients of his previously synthetic composition, and it is now maybe mostly synthetic, but includes finally one natural aromatic. That for me opens the door towards these sorts of projects or these sorts of perfumers evolving into the future towards a 100% natural perfumery style.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, actually. Yeah, as well. It's just kind of like it's that appreciation, isn't it? You know, for the natural material. And then once somebody opens their eyes or they just go like, wow, when they actually are introduced for the first time. And then you have also got, you might have a perfume house, maybe that makes just conventional perfumes, but they're finding it a challenge to make an all natural perfume. And so they just want to maybe make one in their line of maybe they'll have 10 in their range, but they just want one of them to be a really good all natural perfume. That again, where do they find that knowledge on a real professional level? So that's where you'd come in, isn't it?
Definitely. I think it's the key to being a successful perfumer, in my opinion, comes from really getting to know as many aromatics as you can, both natural and synthetic. That is a key part in your development as a perfumer, and it is something that I always invite my students to continue doing. So expanding your perfumer's organ is a job that we have every single day.
Yeah, and I mean that's the good thing about having that community as well, the educational community there, where I mean that's how I got to smell all of the things I got to smell is somebody might send you just a small amount of the material that just to even just have a little sample of it so that you can say, oh wow, I've smelled Seps. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, the mushroom one is quite incredible, but just these incredible materials that you might not smell otherwise when you kind of get involved in a community where other people are passionate about it and they, you know, they want to share maybe a little bit of this or a little bit of that. Unfortunately, Ireland is a little bit like, I mean, we don't have the same kind of natural resources that you do, and it's definitely not as sunny, but we don't have a lot in terms of perfumery materials that are actually produced here. In fact, I don't really think, I think maybe somebody did, might have been one of our students, Anita, did a bit of a thing on seaweed absolute. I think she was looking into that, but I don't know. She was trying to get some grants or something like that from the government for it because we've got an abundance of seaweed. But it doesn't, I mean, okay, it's okay, but it's not like it wouldn't be mainstream perfumery material. We just don't get the We don't get enough sunshine for that. But I mean, there are other things like Solomon, you sent me five materials that I'd never heard of. And if the listener wants to have a look, it's published on our Substack. One of them just really sticks in my mind, and that's the chocolate cosmos, which is just sounds absolutely amazing. And I'm going to try and get it in a garden center here just so that I can smell it. I bet you I can. I've seen cosmos flowers around, but they're always pink or purple. I've never seen the one that you've sent me. But five of them I'd never heard of. I think that's another thing, this kind of connection between Mexico and Ireland, and just the experience of just being able to talk about these botanicals that I'd never heard of before, and then actually have the opportunity to smell them as well.
I completely agree. It's what for me is beautiful of the world of natural perfumery is that it really never stops surprising and amazing you. It's just listening to all of the plants that are grown or found in these different countries and just realizing just how you've never even heard of them. You have no idea of what they smell like. And it of course it automatically triggers something in a perfumer's mind of saying, I definitely want to smell that. Like even right now, as you were expressing about how maybe in Ireland you do not have the abundance of flora or the climate to grow as many different things as maybe a country like Mexico, it is still like part of the identity of each country or territory or region. So I would love if I would love to smell even this Irish seaweed. It's something I have never smelled before, and it definitely comes down to that. It's appreciating what can be found everywhere in the world. And I completely agree that the exciting thing or the exciting twist that natural perfumers are facing right now is that in the 20th century, I feel like there was like a limited number of natural aromatics that were available, that were used, and these were like your common or traditional natural aromatics. And not to say that they are not amazing, of course they are, but at that time, the idea of using something exotic from a country that was never really part of the industry was just unheard of. And something super exciting that is starting to happen in real time is that we do see more and more artisanal, low-scale projects showing up absolutely everywhere in the world, which essentially allow us to smell every single corner of the world out there and all of its wonderful plants.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, people had to travel long distances before a lot of the spices and beautiful botanical materials would only have been available to royalty. And now we're so lucky we can order them. And I think there has to be that kind of respect. And of course, I think that is one of the reasons that I am so into all natural perfumery is really the artisan kind of thing about it. I'd prefer to invest my money in something that I was going to see some return on it rather than just, or some maybe really nice food or something like that, or an experience. So hopefully we're maybe ahead of ourselves or ahead of the game. I don't know what you think about that.
I think that we as a society are starting to put our what would we perceive as value in completely different places. So I think now the value is not necessarily on what the physical object you have in front of you, but rather on all that came before that, all of the hands, all of the processes that came before that. And that is what makes particularly natural aromatics from everywhere in the world so exciting. It's not just the smell. It's not just the fact that it smells amazing. It's knowing where it came from, knowing that someone had to cultivate and to collect and to extract these amazing plants in somewhere so far away, maybe, to know that there was so much work, so much effort, so much love put into that. And that you are now able to smell a little piece of someone's craftsmanship and of a small piece of nature elsewhere in the world is what makes it so mind-blowing. So definitely we're starting to perceive the value on a deeper level and on all of the things that come before the product itself, instead of just seeing the value of what it can do for me right now, and what is the cheapest way to get it.
That's right. Yeah, I think it goes back to appreciation again. And that comes from education, doesn't it? Really, which is where Parfolab comes in terms of giving people that knowledge. so that when they look at that or when they smell that material or that perfume or whatever it is, that they understand the story behind it and where it started, where it came from, and how precious it is, really. And it's only when you actually, like, again, going back to the tea, the wine, the perfume, and the vocabulary, the different types, the descriptors, how it evolves over time and all those things, it's when you actually, you sort of start to kind of like have your eyes open to that, you do tend to smell it in a different way. So like you could open a bottle of osmanthus, take a smell, and you'll have your own mind on what you're smelling and your memories that it evokes and things like that. But when you smell it through a lens of knowledge of what it took to actually get that there into that bottle, and even to go by certain descriptors where you might not be able to put the name or the word on yourself, but like that, like hoping to have that kind of scent panel where there might be somebody listening or watching and picking up a bottle at the same time and suddenly going, oh yeah, there's that suede that they're talking about, and actually get that real appreciation.
Completely agree. Behind every single glass of wine, behind every single cup of tea, and behind every single perfume or natural aromatic, there is a very exciting story of craftsmanship, of connection to nature, which definitely makes the experience way more rewarding. My favorite example of this in something that we teach during our diploma course is things that are produced through destructive distillation. So we specifically talk about fossilized amber. And you can even see it in the faces of our students, how excited they get as you start telling them what it means to actually be able to smell this. So it is not simply a smell. It is not simply an aromatic. It is not simply an aromatic from, for instance, China or Lithuania. It is a story of a million years or millions of years where a prehistoric species of pine that no longer exists at one point had to produce this resin, which over the course of 35 million years or so, depending on where it's from, eventually became fossilized to the point where it no longer had smell, and where we could use it to make jewelry as a semi-precious gemstone, or we could literally destroy it to turn it into an aromatic. And what you're smelling right there in front of you is a result of this entire process. So you are smelling this thanks to a tree that lived 35 million years ago. And that just makes it like way more mind-blowing for everyone. And I definitely see it in my students' eyes where they're all super excited to share what they smell and they just find it even more exquisite than the very smell of it by itself is.
But again, I think it's definitely was the big challenge for me was finding the right words. And so I think that in future, that's something that I think our listener would really be interested in hearing more about from experts like yourself, Solomon.
Thank you so much. A tool that has been super useful to us at Butterfolab is definitely sharing as many fun facts as we can. So rather than just saying, okay, so this is whichever plant and it is produced in whichever way and it comes from whichever country, it's also adding a nice little fun fact that probably has nothing to do with the smell, but it just gives a sense of appreciation that is way, way broader and way more profound than if you were to simply smell stuff. So yes, like we often forget that we live in a fascinating, fascinating world, a world where each and every single plant tells an exquisite story of evolution, of ecology, of natural behavior that it just makes it a way more interesting to appreciate everything that we have right in front of us. And definitely, it all comes down to vocabulary. One of the most important things that I think perfumers should know is that overall, besides all of the few exceptions, all of us have virtually the same ability to smell. It's not like a perfumer's nose is necessarily made out of gold, and a perfumer has a better sense of smell than everyone else. And the same goes for sommeliers. It usually comes down to having the right vocabulary to describe what you are smelling. So learning perfumery and becoming a better perfumer and a better evaluator definitely also involves broadening your vocabulary and actually making an effort to actively and consciously describe aromas in a richer, more specific, and more distinct way than what you maybe did last time. So something that I wholeheartedly took from as a lesson from my time at the Natural Perfume Academy was precisely creating my own aroma or scent diary. And that is something that I also invite my students to do and to continue on doing every single day. And it is just making smell part of your conscious activities that you do every single day, and actively and consciously and intentionally smelling what is right there in front of you. And with the same consciousness, describing it in the best way possible. And your vocabulary simply starts expanding in an amazing way. And I see it with my students, and I'm pretty sure you see it and you've seen it with your students as well. Their descriptions on day one are nothing compared to their descriptions on their last day. And it just shows that actively working every single day to better describe aromas definitely gives fruits, and it results in perfumers being way better at describing what they are smelling, and hence having the perception of the general population that they have a better sense of smell, when in reality it was the absolute same nose all along.
Yeah, I get you, all right. It's a little bit like somebody with a musical ear as well. If somebody plays a certain key in the piano, that they're able to say, okay, that's that key. Again, that's something that you can learn. It's not necessarily, some people have it naturally. They have a natural musical ear, but it is something that you can be taught, that this, when you play this note, this is what it is. But again, with music, it's just that one note. Whereas with perfume, like, let's say, for example, you might have like a plum note and something, but then it's like, well, yeah, what kind of character does that plum note have? Is it a musty plum? Is it an overripe plum? Is it a green plum? And these kind of things. And then again, with perfumery, where you wouldn't do that with maybe tea or wine, you can sort of go on, you can describe kind of where it takes you in your mind as well, which is something that's very special about perfumery as well, isn't it?
Definitely, it definitely is.
Well, I think it's time to wrap it up. And honestly, I think that we could talk the hind legs off a donkey here.
Definitely.
It's been such a pleasure, Solomon. And I know it will not be the last time. And I'm hoping that even we don't have to have a big panel, but I'm going to try and rope Zoe in, and maybe even a panel of six would be fun. And I'll let you know about that. And when this podcast goes live, I would love to dig even deeper into the whole system of smelling. And again, not just how we smell, but how we find the words and how we make associations. Because in that kind of panel, I think that aspiring perfumers would find it really valuable. It just helped them to go, oh, okay, so that's how you do it. And I feel like you're the perfect man to guide us as well, because of course you have the balance with your chemistry background and of course your perfumery background, and then the tea and wine as well. I think it's just fantastic.
Thank you so much, Ruth and Justine, for the invitation. It was a true privilege to spend this amazing time with you chatting about all of these super interesting topics. I would be more than glad to join you again. This is a topic that I'm completely passionate about and that it just gives you so much to talk about. So truly thank you for this space. Thank you for the opportunity. And I will be glad to join you next time.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Solomon, for this absolutely wonderful conversation. And thank you to our listener again for tuning in. And if you have any questions for Solomon or for Zoe ahead of our next recording, you can drop them in the comments. You can just drop us a line. I'm not going to start giving links out and things like that because they will all be shared in the description. I don't think people, that are listening are going to be taking down links, but you can send us an email or just leave them wherever you're listening to this podcast. And I am so proud of this Irish Mexico connection. And I am really looking forward to building many more bridges through these conversations from Galway to Mexico City. Goodbye, Solomon, and goodbye to you, our listener. And we will see you next month.